welcome to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, May 6th, 2014. I'm Scott Burton. I'll be your host today. Today on Juno Afternoon, we will hear from Mandy Massey and Mr. John Dow about the Pillars of America series tomorrow. We'll hear from Simon Roberts and a new Clinkit language app. We'll also hear from the Juno Jazz and Classics. Dimitris Kotranakis will be in the studio to tell us about his performances. And we'll hear from JDHS Theater Director Michelle Moore, and we'll be hearing about the spring production Molière's The Imaginary Invalid, that National Native News Writer's Almanac, and more here on a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Billy Frank Jr. fought for fishing rights all his life. The Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission announced his death Monday. Frank led the organization for decades. The Nisqually man from Washington State was nationally and internationally known for defending treaty rights. In 2009, Frank told National Native News he was hopeful about the new Obama administration.
I think we're going to see some new things that's going to be come alive on consultation, with new things that are going to be coming alive on government to government, and the trust responsibility of the tribes and the U.S. government, our relationship between the states and all of us on the collaboration with one another, and supporting EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, for the long haul. You know, we got 8 years with our president now.
President Obama, the EPA, and tribal leaders are among those extending sympathies to family and friends. Those who worked alongside Frank say he was a tireless advocate. Kat Brigham with the Confederated Tribes of Umatilla Indian Reservation and Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission says Frank was a good friend. The two organizations work together with Pacific Northwest tribes on many issues, including the Pacific Salmon Treaty, signed in the 1980s, and recently salmon run restoration, fish consumption rates, and natural resource management.
I can't think of a negative thing about him because he was always, we got to go, we got to do this, we got to get work in. He was, you know, a really go-getter, and he was a man who didn't have to take the credit, but he deserved a lot of credit, accomplishing the things that were done in the Pacific Northwest.
Charles Hudson with the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission often saw Frank advocating in Washington, D.C. He says tribes will continue that work.
I believe that you're going to see an invigoration of the spirit that Billy Frank brought to our lives. I don't think you will see anybody accept Billy's passing as an end of an era, but rather the beginning of a new one. Billy gave us huge shoulders to stand on. Billy would want us all to pick up the fight and continue.
Frank celebrated his 83rd birthday in March. Funeral services are pending. An Alaska Native organization has responded to the murder of two state troopers in the interior village of Tanana, Alaska. Dan Bross reports from KUAC Public Radio in Fairbanks.
Charging documents say 20-year-old Nathaniel Kangas shot Alaska State Troopers Patrick Scott Johnson and Gabriel Rich as they tried to put his father, Arvin, under arrest outside their home in Tanana on the evening of May 1st. The troopers had flown to the small remote community after the elder Kangas threatened the local village public safety officer. Both Kangases were later taken into custody. Arvin Kangas is a member of a fringe sovereignty group that rejects state authority. Tanana Tribal Council Chief Lester Earhart says the shooting is not representative of the broader community.
I feel greatly sorry about what happened. This is not really the Tanana people. I mean, I'm just upset, really upset about it.
Nathaniel Kangas spoke only briefly at his arraignment, saying he was sorry. His bail was set at $4 million. His father is facing misdemeanor charges. Troopers Johnson, 45, and Rich, 26, were lifelong interior Alaska residents and leave behind families. Funeral services are scheduled for Saturday, May 10th in Fairbanks. For National Native News, I'm Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alaska.
In May 2009, the U.S. Senate confirmed Dr. Yvette Rubideau as director of the Indian Health Service. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome back to A Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, May 6th, 2014. I'm Scott Burton, your Tuesday host. And now in the studio with me is Mandy Massey of the Juno Glacier Valley Rotary Club. Welcome, Mandy.
Hi, Scott.
And also with us is John Dow of the John Dow Foundation. Welcome, John.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, John will be the keynote speaker at the Pillars of America series tomorrow.
That's right. Yes, the Juno Glacier Valley Rotary Club is hosting our 22nd Pillars of America speaker series, and we are honored to have John with us for tomorrow's speaker. And we're really excited. Last week we had 250 students and about 240 adults come and join us. And we're looking forward to a sold-out crowd, if possible. There'll be tickets available at Hearthside Books and at the door.
Okay. And, John, can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself? And I even wonder, I know that storytelling is a big part of your history. Would you like to start by telling us a story?
Sure. This is very important. I'm very happy that you asked this question. I would like to also remind your listeners that I never been to school until I was 17 years old. This is when I started to learn writing A, B, C, D, 1, 2, 3, and so on. So we never been to school at all. But that does not mean we never got any sort of education. The education that we've been getting prior to the modern education, well, the storytelling aspect of our culture in South Sudan. You know, in the United States, before children go to bed or before they sleep, mom or dad or somebody else will read a story to children. Maybe because they want them to sleep very quickly, or maybe that's another way of teaching them. But our case is different from the American storytelling or reading stories to children. Ours has to have participation. Everybody participate in the storytelling. Right after you finish your dinner in South Sudan, in the Dinga area, you go to bed. And before everyone finding their beds and where to sleep and so on, one of the children would say, it is you who tell the story first. And then she would say, no, that's you, tell the story first. And then to the point where nobody, the last person would point to nobody. And so that person would start the story. And we will always be listening and participate and question the story. And then she could come back to her, to me, and then sometimes we even ask mom to give us, we beg mom to give us a story or dad or so on. Sometimes they will say, I'm tired, or they can give you, they can tell a story. But our stories were very important. Why? Because when you tell a story, everyone is participating in it, like asking questions and so on. But then there's the storyteller, that the person will actually ask, what do you think, what is the moral value of the story? Mm. So you, in America, you read a book, but you don't talk about moral value of story. We talk about moral value of story, what that story is giving you. What are you learning from that? Somebody will say, I think it's like this. I think this is the moral value of the story. And so whoever get it right will get some point, we get cows, which means an imaginary cow, like goat. If you get half of it, you get a goat. If you get the whole story, the meaning of it, then you get one cow. And so you accumulate many cows and then get married. So this is like a game, but that's a storytelling. Everyone participates. Sometimes you are even compelled to create your own story. You just have to create something and also create the moral value of that story. So that's what many of those stories helped me until today. And I would like to actually give you one story.
Please do.
And that was about a man called Ayuel who lived with his wife and two sons. They live in a village. These two sons were kind of a spoil. They were not doing anything. I mean, mom and dad asked them to do something, even scaring off chicken that are eating seeds or goat that are coming to stumble on seedling and so on. And they refused. The boys refused. They don't help. Even in the community, they do not help. In that community, in that village, it had become a norm that you can help elderly. You help those who need help. And so children line up. But these two boys are known in the community. They could not do anything at all. They refuse to help. They don't get even help their mom and dad. And so it has been known. And even in the community, they were told to, they can go to what is called Pintar, which means beneath the earth. Beneath the earth is where you don't see, because we didn't even know there's America, there's some other places. We knew that our village is the only place, and then where you cannot see with your eyes is the Pintar. So they were told that, wasting their time, they should go to Pintar because they are lazy boys, they can't help, help other people in the community. And so one day, as there was no enough food and the village fall into this food shortage, starvation was actually getting terrible. And so whatever you can get is whatever you can eat. And so people actually tie oxen, cows on the neck, and then draw blood, and then eat that blood too. So that's what it was. One day, neighbors of these boys, they were struggling tying down a bull, a very big bull. They cannot do it. I mean, the bull was so strong, and they were trying to hold it down so they can draw blood. But the boys were very strong, and they were watching them. They could not go and help. But his father, their father, told them, please go and help. Because if that bull break free, they will come even stumble on your milk. They will even pour your milk. They can come here and maybe destroy stuff. And the boy said, no, he will not come. I mean, so as the neighbors struggled to hold the bull down, quickly the bull broke free and come wild and actually came knocked down milk for the boys. And that was the only milk that they supposed to have for a day. And so the boys went for the whole day without milk, the night without milk until so it was very tough for them. So father said, see, I told you, if you would have been there, help, the bull would have not gotten free and tumble on your milk. And so so from then the boy said, you know what, I think everything is connected. So we must now, from now on, we must help. What is the moral value of the story to the people of Juneau?
Be part of the community.
Oh, yes. Go ahead, sorry.
Right. So I'm asking the people of Juneau, what is the moral value of this story? Maybe you would tell it is this and that, but I want to also maybe give you an answer to this. You will have answer. It doesn't have one answer, but you cannot give it the way you want it. But the moral value of this story is, if you see a family struggling, raising children, and you don't go and help, those children that you are not helping, those families that you are not helping, at some point they may not even, raise their children in the right way because they cannot help. And you know what? Those children that are raised in a wrong way because the parent cannot do it, maybe it can be only one, the mother or a single parent, cannot really juggle between work and raising the children, and you are who doing better well, raising your children there in a good way, you never know. Those bad children you think that are bad, they maybe get into a company with the good children. And you know what? They will spoil them. They will spoil the good children. You think that you're raising your good children, and you neglect to help a family that is struggling. So everything is connected. They will definitely fail your children, whether you like or not. They will definitely. So it is better for you to help those who are struggling, so that because when you help them, you also help yourself. It says it takes a whole village to raise a child. So that's the moral value of the story. What about you who is listening? You can also tell your part of how you understand this story. You can tell the moral value of the story that I told.
And John, what are you planning on doing tomorrow? Are you going to tell some more stories like this one?
I'm going to focus on my message. And if there is a chance to tell more stories, I will definitely do it, because I love storytelling. Because storytelling has been helping me. Right now, all of my life right now being guided by story that I heard. I heard so many stories, and I'm thinking maybe I'm going to put it in a book so that I can share with the American people, children, and anybody that wanted to read them.
John, will you tell us a little bit about your history?
My history, when we talk about the story of survival, it's what I call a living testimony. When I was young, about 12 years old, this is when my village was attacked. It was attacked in 1987. And then I was forced out of my village. From there, that night, when we were attacked in 1987, I was separated from my family. My family took their direction, and I took my own direction with my neighbor, a guy that I thought was my dad. From then, we kind of fled toward east. And then from then, we continued to go to Ethiopia. It took us about 3 months to get there on bad foot. There was nothing to eat. It was very difficult. Wild animals were killing boys on the way. We got to Ethiopia. We stayed there in Ethiopia for 4 years. Starvation, thirst, and diseases were killing boys every single day. Then from there, after 4 years in Ethiopia, we moved back to South Sudan, because the government, the new government of Ethiopia, actually the current government of Ethiopia, didn't like us to be there. So we moved back to South Sudan, and then some of us were killed, some lost their life through river crossing, by, you know, eaten by crocodiles or drowned, others lost. And then we were 27,000. By the time we got to Kenya, a different country, we were 12,000. And until 1999 and 2000, when the American came to the refugee camp to bring us to United States, about 4,000 came to America, 4,000 of us. Some went to Australia, others went to Canada.
And so now that you're in the United States, one of the ways that you give back to South Sudan is through the John Dow Foundation.
That's correct.
Can you tell us a little bit about that and its mission?
Yes. John Dow Foundation is my third organization that I formed. The first one was the Lost Boy Foundation of New York. The second one was the American Care for Sudan Foundation, John Dow Foundation, and South Sudan Institute. I end up forming four nonprofit organizations. But the John Dow Foundation mission is to build a clinic, run the clinic. We built that clinic in 2007, which it's a clinic by name, but it's a hospital that we have treated over 119,000 people, saved their life through that medical clinic. Over 600 people who were completely blind now can see, because we work with an organization called John Moran Eye Center in Utah, helping us. The doctors, whom I call miracle doctors, they came with us twice, 2011, 2012. They did eye surgery for 600 people who were completely blind. These are from different tribes. And over 8,000 mothers gave birth to the clinic for the first time. The same children vaccinated for the first time. So we have been helping even elderly that are very malnourished and so we help them. So the clinic actually has been a beacon for peace, something that have been helping people in South Sudan, not only from my tribe, but I also welcome other tribes that are not from my tribe and then benefit from the American generosity. So that's a way to give back to the American people that have been generously helping us with either writing checks or, you know, giving their time, the doctors, the nurses, anybody that has spread the word. I thought it would be a wonderful way to give back to the American people is to help other people. And that's what we are doing today.
And tomorrow you'll be speaking about this as well, won't you?
Yes. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about that, talking about the story that I call a living testimony, the perseverance. For those who would like to come hear me, please come tomorrow, and that will be a great way to participate in this story.
Well, thank you. And Mandy, can you fill us in on the details again about tomorrow?
Sure. It's not too late to get your tickets. They're available at both Hearthside Book locations and also at the door.
And the doors open at 11:30, is that right?
You actually want to get there very early with parking downtown. As you know, doors open at 11:15.
Okay.
And you know how parking can be difficult down there. So get there early because doors close at 11:50. So be sure to get there on time.
And lunch is included, right?
That's correct.
And it's about an hour, hour and 15?
Hour and a half, I plan for just to get in and out, yeah.
Okay, well, both of you, thank you so much for your time today. John, thank you for coming such a long way to visit us here in Juneau.
Thank you very much.
It's been very nice speaking with you. That's the Pillars of America speaker series tomorrow with John Dow, 11:15 at Centennial Hall. Thanks again, you two.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It is the 6th of May, 2014. It was on this day, 1862, Henry David Thoreau died of tuberculosis, 44 years old. His aunt asked him on his deathbed if he was at peace with God, and Thoreau said, "I was not aware that we had quarreled." It's the birthday of Randall Jarrell, the poet and critic born Nashville, 1914, who helped to revitalize the reputations of Robert Frost and Walt Whitman and William Carlos Williams, and also wrote many poems. He wrote poems during World War II, where he was a control tower operator. In his poem Losses, Jarrell wrote, "We read our mail and counted up our missions in bombers named for girls. We burned the cities we had learned about in school till our lives wore out. Our bodies lay among the people we had killed and never seen. When we lasted long enough, they gave us medals. When we died, they said our casualties were low." It was on this day, 1994, that the Channel Tunnel, the Channel, opened between Britain and France beneath the English Channel. It was the first time Britain had been connected to the mainland since the Ice Age more than 8,000 years ago. They had actually begun digging a tunnel in 1881, but the British military intervened. They were concerned that the tunnel would make it easier for Europeans to attack England. The project was again proposed in 1907 and in 1924 and in 1930. Each time the French were in favor of it and the British in the end vetoed it. One year the cabinet said, "So long as the ocean remains our friend, do not let us deliberately destroy its power to help us." The plan was renewed in the 1960s, but the British government again backed out. And finally, in 1984, Margaret Thatcher announced that she had no interest in the government paying for it, but no objection if it were privately funded, and so the project went underway. Two parallel railway tunnels with a smaller tunnel in between for maintenance. It was officially opened, all three tunnels, on this day in 1994, 31 miles long, cost about $15 billion to build, and it makes it possible to travel by train from London to Paris in less than 3 hours. Here's a poem for today by Diane DeSillis, To Lean. Having injured my shoulder, I dream of racing down the Thames, part of a crew, 16-oared, octuple skull, long, slender shell, symmetrical, keelless, feet fixed, seats glide, lock and socket, stiff armed, sweep of oars, lift of water, bracing, smooth, a lubricant to be part of this synchrony, able to lean on others, ride the breastbone of a bird without wings or even a feather. A poem by Diane DeSillis, To Lean, from her collection Strings Attached, published by Wayne State University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, with assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Welcome back to a Juno Afternoon. I'm Scott Burton, and with me now on the phone is Mr. Simon Roberts. Welcome, Simon.
Thank you for having me. I'm bored.
And you're here to talk about some new Clinklet language apps. Is that right?
Yes. My latest app is called Clinklet Phrases.
Okay.
The app itself, it's a southern dialect. It's not northern dialect, but I am working on a northern dialect app with Gold Belt Heritage, with their team over there. But this app right here is to teach you the phrases. My first two apps that I came out with were based on just the single words so that you could understand some basic words, say some one words inside of the house, like mom, dad, and so forth, to be able to get used to being able to add that into a phrase. I kind of structured it into so you could kind of like how you would hear a child, they would hear single words.
Okay.
They would hear them say single words other than yes and no, but you would hear, they would say food, they would say toy, things like that there. So I kind of tried to implement what I've heard with, as you've seen what Rosetta Stone would always say, in order to learn a language, you must think like a child.
Okay. So I've actually downloaded those apps, and in a minute I want to play some examples off of those. Before we do that, though, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, about your background, and how you got into app design?
What actually inspired me to start developing apps was about 3 years ago, almost 3 years ago, I came across a Haida language app.
Okay.
And I hadn't seen anything out there for Clinkets or Sentience.
Okay.
So that just, like, drove me inside to figure out a way to how to start learning how to develop, how to build these, whether it be from code or from templates or whatever direction it would take to get the language out there available so that we could start teaching our youth, young adults, and those that love to understand the culture as much as they can, whether it be if they want to learn one word or if they want to learn whole sentences. My goal was to be able to make that available and free so you could download right from your phone. And I called it Language on the Go.
Okay.
So you could be sitting on the bus, waiting at the airport, waiting for a meeting, be able to put on some headphones and start going through some of the phrases or single words and start learning these here wherever you're at.
And I have to say it's very accessible. I went to the App Store this morning and was able to download these for free. It didn't take very long at all. And right now, on your suggestion, I have Clinkit Phrases open. Want to see if we can hear one of these? Is there one in particular you'd like me to play?
Yeah, if you scroll down.
Okay.
And
scrolling.
Let's use the word R.U. Simshian.
Okay, let's see. Here we go.
So it's Han Ha'isti.
Okay, I'm going to turn that up a little more and try it again.
So it's Han Ha'isti.
Okay. R.U. Simshian.
Now, the speaker on there is a local here on Prince of Wales where I'm at, Alicia Roberts, an elder, a very well-respected elder here locally, my grandmother, too. And I had been working with her for the past year on gathering as much language. I still have more to get on the phrases. It just seems like there's just, if you look at a dictionary, you kind of get the idea of how many words I got to tackle, even though many of them aren't in the Tlingit language
mm-hmm.
that you would find in a dictionary. And some of them are kind of just for the words or something that you might say over or sound different, even though you're saying the same thing or the semantics of it. There really isn't that much differentiation with the Tlingit language. They just try to say the same word over again. But, you know, when you speak Tlingit, you say the words backwards. You kind of like if you're learning Spanish,
mm-hmm.
You start with the last word first word last, or so forth. It's sort of like that there. When you learn it, the Tlingit language, it's kind of a little complex in a way.
Okay.
But I see it as the more that you start hearing it, the more that you'll be able to start applying it. I always called it kind of like speaking like Yoda.
Yeah.
You ever see he wouldn't say, I have an apple. He would say, an apple I have.
Sure. Sure. And what's the difference between Southern and Northern dialect? Are they really different?
There is a little bit in some of the words. Like our word for bottle down here means jug up there. Theirs for jug in the Northern means bottle down here.
Okay.
But some of them are identical. Now, the Tlingit language is the core language for many languages out there. Now, the Athabascans and the Aleut language, Jordan Lashler out of Ketchikan, a linguistic specialist, had matched the Tlingit language with every language in the world and found out their root language comes from the Tlingit. Then he found that the Salish down there between Canada and Washington, their root language is Tlingit. And he also discovered that the Apaches and the Navajo language is core root language is Tlingit.
Wow.
That's kind of when he said that put that piece right in the puzzle. When I a year before I had seen him at that Sea Alaska luncheon over there, they had every November they always have those there every Tuesday, Thursday. I had met an elder in Ketchikan when I was living there a year before that, and he had told me that during World War II he came across another native and just started speaking to him in Tlingit. And pretty soon I started talking back and replying to what he was saying to him. He said it went on for about 30 minutes and he stopped him and said, what tribe are you? And then he told him that he was Navajo. He didn't know that he was a code talker, but he was able to understand him and vice versa. He said there was just a little bit, some words that they couldn't understand, but majority of it, they understood the whole conversation.
Wow, you know, and this is such an exciting time for native languages with House Bill 216, and it just seems like there's a big resurgence happening. It's really great to see, and this is part of it.
I like what's going on over at Central Council. They never had a language department. Their new president over there, was it Richard Peterson, mentioned that they're in one of their newsletters on their Facebook page saying that they are opening like two or three language departments, one for each one of the languages. Now, that's exciting to see that the tribe is finally investing into their culture instead of just waiting for corporations like Sea Alaska and Gold Belt so forth to do that, to see the tribe invest in their own heritage there to bring that out.
Okay.
So, but as for me, my goal is to get as many languages out there. The future I see with the language apps is more than just doing the language itself and stuff. I'd like to be able to integrate it into things that you'd be able to interact with, flashcards, games, and other aspects to be able to make it part of your life. I still want to do other culturally based apps like how to smoke fish, how to make a dance blanket, things like that there. latest app, other than the Southern, or other than the Tlingit phrases,
mm-hmm.
is the app called Tlingit Song.
Okay, I have that too. Should we play an example of it?
Yes, that'd be nice.
Let's see. Loading it right now. Okay, I'll go to songs, I imagine. And which one should I play, Simon?
Under songs, let's try the... if you scroll down to Haida honoring song.
All right, here we go. So that's one example there among many. Very powerful song there. Simon, can you tell us a little bit about that?
The group there called, here in Prince of Wales, called Hugana, which means warrior in Tlingit. They write most of their music and verify it through the same elder that I use for my apply with my gathering of the language. And they decided back in 2005 to form their group, and over the years they started creating music for it, and they wanted to be able to try to inspire the youth to get into creating their own songs about writing their own stories today, so that and telling it in the language that our elders used to speak, and so that we could try to keep that tradition alive of coming out with new music instead of playing the same traditional music. The traditional music's great, but we could still make new music that sounds like it and be able to keep innovating with it.
Okay. Well, Simon, this has really been nice speaking with you today. Again, these apps are very easy to find. Go to the App Store on your phone and type in Tlingit, and then you can find these apps. It must be very fulfilling to produce these, Simon.
It's been really exciting. I've been glad to be able to gather this content, get it out there for the public to be able to use, and you should be seeing, hopefully within a month, the Gold Belt language app coming out, and this summer I'll be doing the Tsimshian language. I've been working with Donna Mae Roberts, so I haven't tied in that Haida speaker yet. I'm hoping to have a Haida speaker sometime soon to help develop that there for the Northern Kaigani. The other Haida app out there is for Southern Kaigani, and I want to leave you off with a quote here. That I had mentioned on one of the Facebook groups that we had helped create, which is called Tlingit Haida and Tsimshian language apps on there on Facebook group. But one of the people quoted on there says, one customer said that she sounds like my grandmother talking to me.
Well, Simon Roberts, excuse me. Thank you very much for your time today. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
That's pretty much it for now. You should be seeing many more Tlingit language apps coming out within the year, as well as Tsimshian and hopefully Haida later on in this year, as well as games we're aiming for towards the end of the year.
All right, Simon. Thank you so much.
You have a wonderful day.
You too.
Thanks.
Now we're going to hear a cut from the Ataka String Quartet, who will be playing this evening at UAS. And we're listening to a piece here by the Ataka String Quartet. They'll be playing tonight at UAS as part of a workshop. You can go out there and see that. Go to the Juno Jazz and Classics website for more information there. And also playing out at UAS with me now in the studio is Dimitris Kotranakis. How'd I do, Dimitris, on the pronunciation of that?
Very good.
Can you say it for us, please?
It's Dimitris Kotranakis.
Okay.
In Greek.
I like how you say it better. So Dimitris has his guitar with us, and he's going to start us off with a tune, and then we can talk a little bit about your background and all that fun stuff. Yeah. What song are you going to play for us?
I'll play Adagio Opus 44 by Gerard Drozd, a Polish composer. I will only play half of the piece, not all of the piece, but anyway.
Okay.
You will get a sample.
Great, thank you. Beautiful. Thank you.
Thanks.
Dimitris, when did music come into your life, and how did you start playing?
Okay, I was 7 years old and had no idea about classical guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom forced me, actually, to go to the guitar class.
Yeah.
And for several years, I didn't have any intention to become a guitarist or something like that, but I was really good to it. You know, I was practicing, let's say, an hour per day, so it was good. And after, let's say, 10 or 15 years,
mm-hmm.
It was the only thing I wanted to do in my life. Yeah.
What do you like most about it?
That's a tough question, actually, but it's a whole life. I mean, it's so nice to play, not in front of an audience, but just to play the music. It's amazing feeling. So I think that's the thing that I like most in this profession. I love to play.
Good. How much do you practice every day?
I have to practice 3 hours or 4 hours. But I don't have always the time to do it.
Sure.
Yeah. Especially when I'm touring.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're out playing professionally, but otherwise maybe 3 or 4 hours if possible?
Yeah, sure.
But you love it, so it's...
Yeah, I do.
It's good practice,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it is. I love practicing, actually. I love it. I love practicing. I wish I could practice every day 3 or 4 hours, but I can't. I have to teach. I have to... many things every day.
Sure.
Yeah. Take care of my baby.
Yeah, be a dad.
Yeah. I'm a new dad, actually.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. 9 months old.
That's a full-time job in and of itself.
Yes, it is.
But going back to what you said a minute ago, how you love practicing, just a note to parents out there, we do record this show. It is on the website. You can play this back for your kids later. That you love practicing.
Yeah.
Speaking of practicing, you're going to be doing a workshop tonight
That's
out
right.
at UAS. University of Alaska Southeast. What are a few things that you like to teach folks in a workshop like this, or what do you plan to do this evening?
Usually, they want to play something for me.
Mm-hmm.
So they pick something, they play, and we discuss musical or technical issues.
Okay.
I believe that it's going to be something like that.
And do you enjoy the teaching aspect as well?
Yes. Yes, okay. A lot. Of course, I prefer performing.
Sure.
But anyway, it's not bad. Yeah, it's good.
Can you tell us a little bit about that beautiful guitar in your hands?
Okay, this is a Spanish instrument made in Granada, Spain, by a new but really famous luthier, Paco Santiago Marin. Yeah, I love the Spanish sound of a classical guitar. I love it.
Okay. And you're also going to be playing tomorrow as part of a brown bag lunch at the state office building. Mm-hmm. And let's see if I get this gentleman's name right. Andre Chekmazov?
I'm not sure. That's Russian, so I don't know.
Yeah. So that'll be tomorrow at the SOB. And again, you'll be teaching a guitar workshop tonight at UAS, all as part of Juno Jazz and Classics. I wish we had more time.
And there's the evening concert tomorrow.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's here. Thank you for reminding
me. Yes, exactly.
Good job.
Yeah, absolutely.
7 p.m. tomorrow in the performance space at 360 here at KTOO. And will you be doing that one solo?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
Very exciting. Well, Dimitris, thank you for coming in today and sharing your music with us.
Thanks for inviting me. Thank you.
Yeah, anytime. Anything else you'd like to share?
It's so nice to be here. I mean, people in Greece, they think that Alaska is something too exotic, you know, snow and bears and gold. But it is exotic. I mean, it's so nice. The landscapes are really beautiful. I'm really glad to be here. Yeah.
Good. Well, we're glad to have you.
We're
glad to have you here.
Oh.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. We'll see you later.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
In the precious higher than ever before. Yes, we're now for reaching it, and we're breaking new ground, doing it steady going with no adventure before. Just like Armstrong eagled it, stepping, sliding, buzzing with bars on the moon, did it, and we're doing it. Teamwork got up on Mars, got to us as we venture, and we open the door.
Welcome back to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, May 6, 2014. A piece there by the Manhattan Transfer, who will also be playing there at the end of June, Juno Jazz and Classics. And now, here in the studio with me is, I don't know exactly how big the cast is, but a big part of the cast from The Imaginary Invalid. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can we start over here?
Sure.
And do some introductions, please?
Yeah. So I'm Michelle Amore, and I'm the director and theater teacher at Juno Douglas High School. And this cast has 20 students in it, and I brought four, the ones who the plot really revolves around, these four, actually.
Okay.
So I'll let them take turns telling who they are and what they play and giving you a little bit about their character and then maybe their favorite line from the play.
Okay, my name is Kyle Short. I play the lead, the hypochondriac, Art, and the imaginary invalid.
Okay.
Favorite line?
Favorite line would have to be...
You should have had it already.
Okay.
Just go.
Think on it.
I'll think about it.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Liam Porter Bell. I play Harold, which is Art's brother. And he's basically kind of like the polar opposite of Art. He likes to live life and likes to do things, really. And my favorite line of his from the play is probably right when he comes on stage, he's like, "I wrestled a bear today!"
My name is Brita Fagerstrom. I play the character Belle, which is Art's wife, his second wife, I suppose. My character is a gold digger, and I guess my favorite line from the show is the first line that I say when I come in, "Poopums!"
Hi, my name's Megan Wright. I play Tony in the play. I'm the maid of the household that Art and Belle live in, and basically, I'm just like a really super sassy one who like secretly controls everything in a nice way. And my favorite line, I don't know if I have one favorite line, but my favorite fact about the play is there are so many puns. Just like puns littered everywhere.
Okay, it sounds like y'all are... Did you think of your line?
Yes. So my favorite line is where I say in a loud, clear voice, "I am not healthy!"
And you all are going to be doing this, but for one weekend only.
One weekend.
When's that going to be?
So this weekend, it all starts, right? Thursday night at 7, Friday night at 7, Saturday night at 7, and Saturday at 2.
Okay. You said Saturday night at 7 also.
Yes.
So three nights in a row and then a matinee on Saturday at 2?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
There at the Juno Douglas High School Auditorium?
Yes, sir.
Okay, cast of 20. What do you think Molière was trying to communicate with this play?
I think the main plot has to do with Art and his brother, how there are some people who sit back and let life happen to them,
mm-hmm.
and others who go and make life happen. And I think that's the main gist of the play, that it doesn't matter, you can't make excuses about what you're handed. each day is yours to construct the way that you want to construct it, and we're promised days.
And how long have you all been rehearsing for this?
What is it, like a month and a half now?
Month, couple months, yeah.
It's been a lot of hard work, I imagine.
Definitely, mm-hmm. definitely.
But fun?
Yeah, lots of fun.
A lot of late nights, but good.
Yeah, we're all like a really big family in the cast. Like, we've all been friends before, and it's just really great to have a community like that.
Yeah, a lot of the people in the cast, we've met them before and we know them, but they're somewhat new to doing straight plays. They've done musicals before, but it's been really nice to get a new feel to the department, get some new people in there, and they're having a lot of fun, which is great to see.
Mm-hmm. And we're having fun too.
Yeah.
And what's different about this one is the kids created and painted the set themselves. And one thing that's really lovely about the set is a lot of the kids painted big, I mean, huge paintings that are the backdrop of the set. And that was really special to see as well. And there were probably 12 students who painted paintings, and then the rest painted the furniture. And it takes place in the 1960s, which we want to say. The play Molière's version has been facelifted, and we're doing the adaptation that was done just a few years ago at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival to raving reviews and success. And last year we actually saw this play performed at the Fringe Festival that we were fortunate enough to be invited to go perform at. And this was the play that one of the other high schools brought. And the students that were with me fell in love with this play. And
definitely.
I did too. And I said, okay, we'll do it next year. We'll bring it to Juno.
Great, great. Where can people get tickets?
So at Hearthside or thejack.org, and they really do want to buy the tickets beforehand. They're $10 beforehand. If you wait and buy them at the door, they're $5 more, so they're $15 at the door, although I think that both prices are really good prices for such a great show.
Okay, we're just about out of time. Anything else anyone would like to add? I wish we could talk more about it. We'll just have to go out to the play and see it.
Yeah.
There is a surprise ending. I want everyone to know that. It's a beautiful ending, and it is a surprise.
All right, well, thank you all again so much for coming in, and good luck with the play this weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
At 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable, on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And please tune in to a Juno Afternoon tomorrow on Wednesday, May 7th, 2014. Same place, same time. We'll join All Things Considered Already in Progress.